All set to go.
Okay. We would like to welcome back to the program Jeffersonian hero, Dr. Mark Andrew Holachek, philosopher and historian. He's the author, editor of 15 books with several more to come and well over 100 published essays on Thomas Jefferson. He's also the author of many other books and numerous essays on psychotherapy, Greek, Roman philosophy, ethics, philosophy of education, philosophy of sport, and critical thinking, which seems to be lacking today, among other things. He passes his time in the study of Jefferson's mind and is currently retired after 33 years of teaching philosophy, classics, history, philosophy of science, and psychology. Dr. Holachek continues to face leftist censorship from the mainstream as he dares to apply reason and objective thinking to the historiography of Thomas Jefferson. The preeminent Jeffersonian scholar of our time returns to TRP to celebrate American independence and discuss the principles of the Declaration of Independence and the philosophy of Jeffersonianism.
One of the problems with the Declaration is its independence because that had been done already. Mm-hmm. On July 2 of 1776, the Continental Congress had voted on and passed the resolution and formally declared that the United States, the individual states, were independent. They declared their independence from Great Britain. So in that draft, that resolution was at the behest of Richard Henry Lee. And Thomas Jefferson states in the opening paragraph of I want to focus on his rough draft of the Declaration, and by that I mean what we have reconstructed of Jefferson's draft before it went to the hands of the four other members of the committee, notably John Adams and Benjamin Franklin worked on it and offered some slight modifications, and then the Continental Congress read the document and made substantial edits. About 33% of the current document was excised. But Jefferson writes on May 8th of 1825, and I'll read his letter. He writes to Richard Henry Lee about the purpose. He says, "When forced to resort to arms for redress, an appeal to the tribunal of the world was deemed proper for our justification. This was the object of the Declaration of Independence, not to find out new principles or new grounds never before thought of, not merely to say things which had never been said before, but to place before mankind," now notice he says before mankind, he's appealing to all the people around the globe, "the common sense of the subject in terms so plain and firm as to command their assent, and to justify ourselves in the independent stand we are compelled to take. Neither aiming at originality of principle or sentiment, nor yet copied from any particular in previous writing, it was intended to be an expression of the American mind, and to give to that expression the proper tone and spirit called for by the occasion. All of its authority rests then on the harmonizing sentiments of the day, but in some sense, the notion of the Declaration being a declaration that formally declared independence, it was not the aim of the Declaration, because that had been done 2 days prior on a resolution that passed through the Continental Congress and that was pushed by Richard Henry Lee on July 2, 1776. So that was scripted. So the Confederation of States were already declared their independence, and that was formally done. So what was the Declaration of Independence that passed a couple days later? And in some sense, it was, as Jefferson said in an 1825 letter to Richard Henry Lee, that it was an appeal to the tribunal of the world, a sort of explanation for what the Confederation of States were doing in their attempt to separate themselves from the mother country, right? And Jefferson admits in his own articulation of the document that he's trying to harmonize the sentiments of other thinkers, of Aristotle, of Cicero, of Locke, of Sidney, and many other, of course, John Locke, of course, and many other people in the Declaration. So he's not aiming at originality. He never professed. A lot of people complain that, oh, it's not a highly original document. And Jefferson plainly said it wasn't meant to be. It was meant to be my summation of the spirit of the times in America at while the members of the Congress were aiming at revolution. So it wasn't an original document, and Jefferson never claimed to be that he was crafting something original, but he did craft something quite powerful.
A couple of the callers who you spoke to last time, of course, our producer, John from Connecticut, and George the Objectivist. Maybe you could answer their question. I have some idea of that. Not only was it, I believe, a declaration of independence, but it was a declaration of the evolution of independence, because it didn't become a monarchy, it didn't become a dictatorship, kept on evolving. And now we're seeing the forces of neo-Bolshevism try to overturn it. These people are psychologically damaged, they're politically damaged, and they're historically damaged. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. They want to get rid of Mount Rushmore, topple statues, you know, like truculent little children who are angry and throwing their temper tantrum because they have no idea of the richness of the history of America and of Thomas Jefferson. What is your opinion?
Well, I shared with John from Connecticut a short piece that I penned today, which talks about, you're familiar with the 1619 Project of the New York Times, I assume?
Yes, but I cut my subscription to that last year. I don't want to read, I wouldn't pay for that nonsense.
Well, let me just tell you a little bit about the project. It was begun by a notion of Nicole Hannah Jones, and she suggested that we reconsider the founding of this nation. Forget July 4th. Let's go back to the year 1619 when the first 20 African Americans were voted in from Africa. That's going to be the year of the founding of the country. Now, this is a very powerful movement with the New York Times, and if you'll stay with me for a minute, I'm going to read you three paragraphs from the editor-in-chief of the New York Times Magazine. His name is Jay Silverstein. Now, this will make you nauseous, so please bear with me while I read this. If you think you weren't feeling too good now, you'll feel even worse once I finish. He writes, 1619 is not a year that most Americans know as a notable date in our country's history. Those who do are, at most, a tiny fraction of those who can tell you what 1776 is the year of our nation's birth. What if, however, we were to tell you that the moment of the country's defining contradictions first came into the world late in August of 1619? That was when a ship arrived at Point Comfort in the British colony of Virginia, bearing a cargo of 20 to 30 enslaved Africans. Their arrival inaugurated a barbaric system of chattel slavery that would last for the next 250 years. This is sometimes referred to as the country's original sin, but it is more than that. It is country's very origin. Now, pay special attention to the second paragraph. Out of slavery and the anti-black racism it required grew nearly everything that has truly made America exceptional. Its economic might, its industrial power, its electoral system, its diet and popular music, the inequities of its public health and education, its astonishing penchant for violence, its income equality, the example it sets for the world as a land of freedom and equality, its slang, its legal system, and the endemic racial fears and hatred that continue to plague it to this day. These are all slamming the American system. The seeds of all that were planted long before our official birth date in 1776, when the men known as our founders formally declared independence. Finally, the last paragraph, two sentences. The goal of the 1619 Project is to reframe American history by considering what it would mean to regard 1619 as our nation's birth year. Doing so requires us to place the consequences of slavery and the contributions of black Americans at the very center of the story we tell ourselves about who we are as the country. So this is a very strong popular movement started by the New York Times Magazine to tell the story of the birth of America, beginning with the year 1619, and it sort of eviscerates the notion of American heroism, of the founding fathers fighting British oppression, of the struggles of Washington and the armies in the Revolutionary War. All this is inconsequential. The driving force of America is whites hating blacks, is its inveterate racism, according to the view here. So according to this view, I'll send you a copy of the paper I wrote tomorrow by email if you'd like. According to this view, we are a nation that should be wallowing in guilt instead of being proud of our patriotism. And you notice the enumeration of all things of American culture. Our industrial power is a bad. Our economic might is a bad. Our music is bad. The public health and education system is bad. We have more violence than any other place. Income inequality, right? So we are setting the worst example for all the other countries in the rest of the world. Now, here's a question I ask for you, Frank.
Yes.
What follows from all this if the country is so bad? You know, I thought at some point the thesis that you throw out a lot, that these people are trying to destroy what we have, I thought that was an embellishment, a hyperbolic statement. I no longer think it is. I think people like this really, if you follow the strain of what they're arguing for, they're trying to eradicate what the country stands for. They're trying to uproot the whole system. That's the only thing that follows. Now, the question I have is, what are they offering us as a solution? They're silent there. And I will add that Silverstein and Hannah Jones themselves are no doubt profiting handsomely, and I mean monetarily, right, by a corrupt system that allows them to speak freely the bullshit that they speak.
Right. That's right. And you know what, Professor? To me, it goes back further than 1619. It goes back to 1492. And I said this during the Columbian Exposition, because as a philatelist, I finally had the whole Columbian Exposition set of stamps, and then they reprinted them on souvenir sheets. And they started this crap then. And I said, and you notice the way they vilify the great Cristoforo Colombo. And I said, if you start with the supposition that America was founded upon acts of exploitation, slavery, and genocide, then it's only logical that everything else that follows, and the left then the supposition is, we don't have to follow the law because this is an illegal government, and that is what they are doing. These are neo-Bolsheviks who are straight out of George Orwell. They control the present, then they can control the future. They control the past, they control the present. And that's what they've been doing. So they want to change 1776 to 1619. That's exactly what they want to do. This is an illegal, inhumane system based on slavery, economic exploitation. And I don't use terms that the neo-Bolsheviks have come out with. Racial justice, economic justice, environmental justice. These are all faux catchphrases for them to infiltrate governments, and then they can control our way of life. Because what? Why, you have a gasoline engine car. Well, you don't need cars. That's environmental. You need environmental justice. Or maybe they'll start with concentration camps, which, if you notice, they called when it was in Vietnam, when it was in Bolshevik Russia, Bolshevik China, re-education camps, labor camps. Never mind that people were worked to death and the greatest genocides in history came under Bolshevism and its many perverted and sick, sadistic, homicidal, nihilistic system. So that's what this is all about. Rewrite the past, you will control the present, and you will control the future. And the universities are nothing more than vermin nests of vermin that the neo-Bolsheviks have infiltrated. Professor, I had a course on Mao. And the professor, and I'm going back to 1977, and he wrote a book on it. He went to China during the so-called Cultural Revolution. This idiot with a degree, he's a PhD, he was praising the Red Guards and the Cultural Revolution. And you could see the fanaticism in his eyes when he said, they took the intellectuals out of the universities and forced them on to the collective farms where they had to learn from the peasants, and they learned from the peasants how to build a bridge out of woods. This guy was a real sick fanatic. So I said to him, look, professor, why don't you get a semi and become a trucker and learn from the truckers? That's how sick these people are. Their whole supposition is America is evil, and since its foundations are evil, it has to be that everything else is evil. And since the blessed founding fathers, some had slaves, well, therefore they were evil and they should not be honored. Imagine this, they want to get rid of Mount Rushmore because the Beringian Sioux keep saying this is our land. But nobody ever says to the Beringian Sioux tribe, wait a minute, you're the people who tell us we do not own the land, we are guardians of the land. Well, since you said yourself you don't own it, you guard it, well, who the hell are you to tell me that we got to take care of our monuments? There's a visceral move for a neo-Bolshevik cultural revolution, and that's why they want to totally erase the past.
Well, certainly when you read things like the New York Times Magazine's project, 1619 Project, that certainly seems to be what people like that are aiming at. One could question whether or not they're just bright enough to affect such a change. I might disagree with you. I think people like Silverstein and Hannah Jones are working within the system, denigrating the system, talking about how cancerous it is, and, like I said, benefiting monetarily. You know, if the inequality between the haves and have-not is so egregiously bad, is Silverstein, who is the editor-in-chief of the magazine and certainly makes a handsome salary, is he donating most of his salary to projects aimed to lessen that gap? I doubt that. So he's tearing down the system verbally while he's benefiting handsomely from the system. So I wonder to what extent, you know, these people are really well equipped to, do they have a plan? What's next? And in the paper that I'll send you tomorrow, they don't outline any plan. If the system is so incurably corrupt, then instead of just talking about it being such a bad system, what is your plan for reconstruction? Now, there are two things. There are only two options. One is just to tear the whole damn thing down, right? They don't talk of doing that necessarily. The other is that we sit around and wallow in guilt. And specifically, according to their plan, it's the white people who are not up with the 1619 Project that ought to be wallowing in guilt. We ought to just sit around and feel sorry for ourselves, self-flagellate, keep doing that, right? So we ought to just keep beating ourselves and just swimming in our own guilt. And either plan sounds kind of ridiculous. But as I mentioned, a lot of the people that are the greatest calumniators of the system are the greatest abusers from within the system.
Well, you know, they always do that. They make their money off of it, the chaos, and then that's how they keep what they want. But when you have people in the universities that are teaching this crap, the kids who shouldn't be in at a young age, who should wait till they're, like I did, till I was 25 till I went to college and I worked and I had real world experience and I did a lot of reading and I saw through this nonsense. But what they just want to do is totally poison young minds and use them as their shock troops of destruction. I mean, you know, the New York Times, as you know, was once a really great paper, but it has deteriorated now to the point to where I don't want to bother with it anymore. And that's what they want to do.
But when you read stuff like that, it makes you nauseous. It really does.
That makes you a very formidable Huggins stick.
I mean, the real question I have is, what are the history books of tomorrow going to look like? They're going to be filled with fiction, politically correct fiction, and that's a sort of scary thing. Now, I add that in opposition to the project that they're putting forth, some of the most important American historians signed a letter objecting to what they were trying to do and demanded that they do something to rectify it. And in response to that, Silverstein pretty much thumbed his nose at that. They're going to go forward with the project. Because, as Hannah Jones said, and I have a quote in the paper I'll send you, you know, the New York Times is selling a lot of papers these days. It's an exciting time, right? It's a busy time. It's a prosperous time for their paper, for their magazine.
Oh. Yeah, well, to me, the paper started deteriorating when Pinch Schulzberger took over, and it's been downhill ever since. But I want to ask you, Doctor, you know, you could extrapolate this to the point of, well, they should tear down the Colosseum in Rome because that was a symbol of slavery since slaves fought as gladiators, Christians were fed to the lions. I mean, tear down every monument in Italy because under the Romans, slavery was an industry. Why just stop at this instead of 1619? Why don't you go back to 300, 400, 500 B.C. in Italy? I mean, it's absurd.
It's absurd. The underlying premise of the argument, naively, is almost that slavery just started in 1619, right, in North America. Well, as you mentioned, slavery is an institution that has been around so long as human beings have been around. And I want to iterate a notion that I've made before, is that in Jefferson's day, in Enlightenment times, this is the first time really in the history of the world that people are starting to take serious the notions of liberty as a substantive concept, number one, and two, in human equality, as articulated so neatly in Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. Everybody who signed off on the Declaration understood the concepts of liberty and the requirements that liberty demanded of each citizen, the work it required, that there needed to be full participation in governmental affairs, right? There needed to be restrictions on their own actions insofar as those actions might impinge upon other people's liberties, okay? And the notion of human equality. This was the first time people were taking it seriously, and those who signed off on the Declaration were, I believe, mostly aware of that something different was being articulated and signed for the first time. Now, I want to say that equality was a new concept at the time. Aristotle said, you know, and he was, what, born 384 B.C., lived to 322 B.C., he said to treat unequals as equals is to treat people as unequals. The notion of human inequality was the driving concept of history throughout millennia until Enlightenment times. And a lot of the people, even in that time, didn't believe that all people were equal. And there were all sorts of, you know, discussions and scientific assessments trying to understand to what sense can we cash out the notion of equality. For Jefferson, I believe, and I've said this in many publications, the equality was moral equality, not based on rationality or intelligence. All people had the same capacity for morally sensitive behavior. And by virtue of that, that's the sense of equality articulated in his declaration. By virtue of that, all people are deserving of equal rights.
Could you walk us through the thread of the argument in the Declaration of Independence?
Yeah, I was planning on doing this rather thoroughly. I'm going to be a little bit more succinct. I want to look at, and I want to focus on Jefferson's draft. So if any of your listeners have access from an online version of Jefferson's original draft of the Declaration before, you know, 33% or so of it was excised, I want to talk about that because that's what tells us most about Jefferson. I'll read a little bit of it, and then I'm just going to sum and give you the thread. So we want to understand we're going to be celebrating, and I hope we're going to be celebrating our country and the great efforts of the founding fathers tomorrow in focusing on and keep these great men and women in mind as we celebrate and enjoy beverages and food and fire off our works. But here's the opening salvo, which, and notice how beautifully Jefferson articulates the problem and defines his audience. He writes, this is Jefferson's draft, "When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for people to advance from that subordination in which they have hitherto remained and to assume among the powers of the earth the equal and independent station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the change." Again, as in the letter to Richard Henry Lee, we have an appeal to the opinions of mankind, to all people everywhere. There is the notion that all people understand that we're by nature free, we're by nature equal. Okay, then he goes to the next paragraph, and this is the meat and potatoes of the argument. He says, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." Now notice in the draft that was accepted by Congress, sacred and undeniable is replaced by self-evident. We have a semicolon, "that all men are created equal and independent, that from the equal creation they derive rights inherent and inalienable, among which are the preservation of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness." We have a semicolon. I'll make a couple comments here. John Locke talked about the rights of life, liberty, and property. Jefferson focuses on happiness. Probably for two reasons. One, the focus on property would go back and bring back the issue of slavery. And it's a contentious issue that doesn't need to be discussed at this time because many of the people in the Continental Congress are pro-slavery. And while at war with Britain, it's not the time to discuss the viciousness or the moral aspects of slavery. So happiness. Why happiness? Well, Jefferson was well-versed in ancient Greek and Roman literature, the virtue ethics people. And again, virtue ethics, the aim of life is eudaimonia, is happiness. So Jefferson I call a liberal eudaimonist. In other words, someone who is a liberal in the Jeffersonian sense we talked of in many times. But the aim is not liberty, it's liberty for the sake of human happiness, human flourishing. Okay, so that's the two important driving claims from which the other claims are derivable. So Jefferson continues, "that to secure these ends, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." It's the people, Jefferson asserts in this claim, that really run the government. The government are elected representatives. Then he writes, "that whenever any form of government shall become destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness." Now here is when government is abusive of the rights of the people. And Jefferson says later, "when the abuses are long-standing and directed towards the same ends, the people have a right to rise up, overthrow the government." And Jefferson will say thereafter, "we never want to do this for trite reasons. The abuses must be long-standing, aimed towards the same end, and without any hope of remedy." He, you know, his worry is that if you effect a revolution government and you institute a government that's no better, what was the point of such loss of human blood? Okay, so that's the important part. He goes into a list of 24 transgressions of King George, at least according to where he places his semicolons, his colons rather. We have 24, and they may, you know, be more because some of these transgressions are conjunctive claims. They're and statements that can be broken apart. So at least 24 grievances. And Jefferson here is rather thorough. Now, I want to point attention to the 24th. And John and I will probably discuss this a little. This is a claim about the injustice of the institution of slavery. And Jefferson points, directs this right to King George, and he says, this is piratical warfare. The opprobrium of infidel powers is the warfare of the Christian king of Great Britain, determined to keep open a market where men, he capitalizes M-E-N, should be bought and sold. He has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or restrain the execrable commerce. Right? This passage is 169 words. The next closest complaint is 52 words. So this is three times longer than the longest other transgression. Now, Jefferson places it last. That is critical. It shows that the institution of slavery, that its eradication was highly important. He wanted to put it in an important part of the document. The Congress read it, told Jefferson it needs to come out. The issue just was too hot. It was too divisive to be tackled. And the Congress was right to say that. It just wasn't the right time. Okay, Jefferson then goes on to talk about George's tyranny, that the colonists have done everything that they can to try to force George to change his actions, and nothing has happened. And then the final paragraph that Jefferson articulates, which is trimmed down in the Congress's version of it, is talking about the dissolution, where the colonists, Jefferson is talking about, okay, because of all these abuses, these are longstanding abuses directed towards the same end, we are effecting a dissolution with the mother country, and he ends it with the beautiful and powerful statement, and for the support of this declaration, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. That is a moving, highly articulate, beautiful, sublime statement of what the colonists aim to do. They want to establish a country that is respective of the rights of the citizens, where those who govern are governing in the interests of the people, the vox populi in Latin. So we have an argument, I'll sum briefly in my own words. We start with all people are being created equal, people are social animals. Okay, all people, therefore, are endowed with rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, so they can live peaceably in a social setting. Then he goes on to say governmental power is derived from the consent of the people. From that, it follows that the main task of government, if it's derived from the consent of the people, is to secure citizens' rights. Jefferson always said that to his dying day. When a government fails to secure the rights of the citizens have a right to overthrow it, and the implicit claim, given the 24 transgressions, is that George clearly has been transgressing his authority, so we have a right to overthrow the government. It is a document of matchless power, and in Jefferson's pen, behind Jefferson's pen, it's, you know, very few people could have penned such a thing. It's a moving, beautiful document.
Why has the Declaration become so popular, such a significant document?
We've got John from Connecticut on the line as well.
Oh, put John from Connecticut on.
Yeah, he's on. Hey, John.
Gentlemen, you did a great job there, kind of summarizing it, that it's the philosophical foundations that make this country great, and he really summed it up. He put the backbone, the cornerstone for our country, and put these principles, again, taking it from some of the great minds and some even from the Virginia Declaration of Rights, June 12, 1776, So he kind of just took it all, and then only the wordsmith Jefferson can do, made such a powerful document, and as I'm sure you were going to talk of, why it's so popular based on that.
Yeah, well, there are many reasons why I think it's become a popular document. One is, and I'd like to say something about this in a bit, not right now, but when we look at it within the context of the Bell Letters of his day, it's a beautifully written document. Jefferson, in the opening paragraph, clearly defines the purpose of the document and the content. The thread of the argument that I summarized runs so beautifully and neatly. And Jefferson was meticulous in everything that he did, whether designing architecturally a building, a garden, whether analyzing poetry, as he writes in that wonderful piece to the Marquis de Lafayette, Thoughts on English Prosody. Anything he did, scholars recognize he did to the best of his ability. So it's just wonderfully written. The argument is easy to follow. That's one reason. he succeeds. In the opening paragraph, he says he wants to capture the harmonizing sentiments of the day. He succeeds beautifully in that purpose. That's the second reason. It's become sort of like, for you old farts out there, remember Steppenwolf Wolf and Born to be Wild, how that was a rock anthem for a generation of youngsters growing up in the 60s, early 70s. This was an anthem for people who were breathing the air of liberty, who wanted to breathe the air of liberty. A third reason, it's something I hinted at, it was written by Thomas Jefferson. Very few people could have pulled that off. And Adams, when Jefferson came into the Congress, he said, you know, one of the things about Jefferson is that he was noted, let's see if I have a quote here, he says, he brought with him to the Congress a reputation for literature, science, and a happy talent for composition. Writings of his were handed about remarkable for the peculiar felicity of expression. And, of course, he gained that felicity of expression through the other documents that he wrote, the summary view written 2 years before the Declaration. Three, and these are important points. I want to talk about this a little later. Hugh Blair, who wrote a beautiful book that I'm just finishing, that Jefferson absolutely loved. It was his go-to book for Bell Letters in Rhetoric. It's called Lectures on Rhetoric in Bell Letters. Said, you know, one of the things to write effectively is authenticity. And what he means by that, authenticity means, is that you believe in the words you pen. Now, when we see the sort of crap that comes out from a lot of people who are bashing Jefferson and trying to uproot or deracinate the founding fathers from, you know, the founding of the nation, do they really believe what they're writing? I don't think so. They're gaining an audience. They're making money. Jefferson wrote from the heart. He believes those principles that are written in the Declaration. And as one historian said quite neatly, the Declaration in time becomes the birth certificate of the United States. The last reason I'll state is that the Declaration contains the germ. It's a precis of a robust political philosophy that Jefferson himself held consistently throughout his life.
Right, but according to the left, they were just white-haired, wooden teeth, passe gentlemen that we have nothing to learn from. They don't realize that the very reason they have the right to speak freely today is because of these gentlemen, but yet they are passe, and we really don't need to put too much into it. Can you imagine what they're missing here, the greatness of what these men accomplished? And the penman of this greatness and of this philosophy was Jefferson, and that we have so much to thank him for. Can you imagine they're trying to blot them out of history? And that reminds me of this nothing, this some little nothing director called Arlen Parso, who blotted out the faces with red ink, the great founding fathers, from John Trumbull's great work of 1818. Can you talk about that disgrace, Doctor?
Yeah, I penned a paper on that as well, a short paper, and it's on my Facebook. I have a Facebook page called Thomas Jefferson, Bring Him Home to Monticello, and it's up there. He's a film producer, and he, you know, following all the sort of racial tension that's been extant for the past 5, 6, 7 years, this is not a new thing, by the way. The racial tension's been festering, been growing in the media for a long time. So the recent events are just more symptoms of that. He decided that he's going to take John Trumbull's beautiful painting of the Declaration, which began in miniature. Trumbull was an artist friend of Jefferson. Jefferson met Trumbull, I believe, in England, and invited Trumbull to stay with him while he was in France in 1786 in Paris, and he set up a studio right in Jefferson's house. But as the story gets told, of course, Sally Hemings was with him, and he was having sex every 5 seconds with Sally Hemings.
Yeah. Right. Scumbag leftist lie, that is. Go ahead, Doctor.
Well, yeah, so Parsa takes him upon himself, you know, and to pass the time to identify all the founders in the, all the people who, signers of Declaration, Trumbull's painting. And Trumbull did not paint from memory. He wanted to look at actual or have people sit for him when he painted their faces so they could be identifiable. So this guy goes out and he just does a check mark, put a check mark, but he blots out the faces. And as I say in my piece, what's the significance of blotting out? It goes back to the simple syllogism. Slavery is bad. Anyone who owns slaves must be a bad person.
Right.
These people own slaves. They're bad people. As if somehow that syllogism has any weight or merit. There are many people who owned slaves that weren't bad, that treated their slaves well. And as we know, the institution existed for millennia. So, this is little person who's certainly trying to capture the political left sentiment that's going on and, you know, gain monetarily from it. I actually sent him a very nasty email.
Oh, good.
And, of course, he didn't respond to it. I went to his webpage and said, you ought to do some reading on the stuff that you're going to write, you know, if you want to tell the true story. And it's just shameful.
And look at the minuteness of the left-wing brain to not understand this and to criticize him somehow for not being such a trailblazer as to done everything he did in his lifetime, which is insurmountable to these little peons who aren't even bird crap on the statue of Jefferson, for them to dare doubt him. But look at all he did do during his lifetime to try and get rid of slavery. And maybe you can explain some of this, but everybody needs to know that that passage that you read from the Declaration was excised. He wanted to stamp it and engross it in the 1776 document. In 1784, in the land ordinance, he wanted to make it impossible for slavery to extend into the territories. And it was the vote of one guy, Dobbs Spate, that dope, that didn't allow that to happen at the time. So he was beyond himself. He was trying to extend forward and take this to the next level. But he was stopped at every turn. That's the disgrace of this. And now you're going to look back at him and criticize him. And his slaves, as we know, loved him. He considered them as wards. He was trying to educate them, to take them off an uncivilized continent and bring them here and teach them about the principles of free enterprise and living with liberty and freedom and attaining that. This is what he was there to do, and this is what he was expressing. But no, because he owned slaves and he didn't eliminate it during his life. What if we said, Doc, you haven't eliminated abortion in your life, so you're evil? I mean, can you now touch a little bit on this to the extent of what he really was? Was he the racist that he's painted to be? And what did he do, in fact, push back against slavery as we know that he did?
Well, he had pretty much an early lifetime of a history of actions, of activities designed to eradicate the institution from expression in his summary view of the rights of British America 2 years before the Declaration to the passage in the Declaration that was excised. Now, people say, well, he's writing. This doesn't mean anything. He's not doing. Why isn't writing doing? Do not people read things that are written? There's the old saying that the pen is mightier than the sword, and in some instances, probably most, that is true. Jefferson was sticking his neck out as a Virginian, as a Southerner, by saying slavery is wrong and it needs to be eradicated. He did not make a lot of friends from people in the South, certainly because of that stance. By making that known early on in the Continental Congress, he was sticking out his neck. Now, there's also, you know, as a lawyer, he was a fairly successful lawyer, and many people do not study enough the years of preparation and practice of law. I have a chapter in my book on Jefferson as a lawyer, in one of my books on Jefferson, in the practice of law. There are other people who have written on it better. Dumford, I believe, better on who know more about legal practice. But Jefferson believed that a lawyer needed to be omnilegent, needed to read everything and pretty much to know everything of any practical significance. And he is noted for taking up the Samuel Howell in Howell versus Netherland case. And Howell was a quadroon, and he was seeking his independence a few years prior to it. And Jefferson argues rather articulately, and the other lawyer involved in the case is his lifelong buddy, George Wythe. He argues rather articulately that by the law of nature, all people, he says, let me get the quote here, under the law of nature, all men are born free. Everyone comes into the world with a right to his own person, which includes the liberty of moving and using it as his will. This is 6 years before the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson took the case and lost before Wythe even had an opportunity to object to the case that Jefferson made. The judges just threw the case out. Jefferson's case, you know, slavery was so much ingrained in the minds of the people. Jefferson trying to argue that all people were by nature free, no one wanted to hear that at the time, 6 years. Now, what people don't know is that he took the case, he took up six cases in total, pro bono, not one. The history books are, you know, filled with, okay, Jefferson took up one case. If you go to his documents, he took up six cases, didn't ask for money for any of them. And he always took up the person who was seeking freedom, the black person or the partly black person seeking freedom, did not ask for money for that. Is that significant? I suggest so. We mentioned the revisal of Virginia's laws in Bill 51. The bill before Congress in 1776, we talked of the bill of 1784 on the government of the Western Territory, which was pretty much enacted, where Jefferson wants clause of slavery. That was excised in the 1787 document, but he wants to push for eradication of slavery. His sixth annual message, which actually banned the importation of slaves as president in 1806. I think the ban went into effect in 1808. He did free some of his own slaves, and scholars say he freed too few, and they're all in the Hemings family, proof of his relationship with Sally.
What a joke.
Now, he freed slaves. Here's 2 points I want to make. Is one is that he knew that there's one problem. Where are you going to go if you're a freed slave? You got to leave Virginia. Where are you going to go? And I ask that question sincerely. People all too freely just think, okay, you free them, and it's fine. In my own research on a book on Lynchburg, which I just completed, there's a case of a black man who was a slave, and then after the Civil War, after emancipation, he went off on his own, came back a few years later to his former owner, says, would you please take me back in some capacity, because I just can't make it on my own, right? It's just too difficult. A black person freed, especially one who is dark-skinned, is not going to find life easy anywhere he went at the time, right? But the history books are not filled with stories of slaves that were freed that did not have a good end, the stories that did not have a good ending. So where are you going to go? Jefferson was aware of that, and he knew his slaves had it pretty well. And as you mentioned, he was well-loved by them, right? When he came back as minister plenipotentiary from France, the slaves rushed down the mountain and carried him up, and they were teared. And his daughter, Martha, writes of the event as if it took her by surprise. She never expected it. He was well-loved by most of his slaves, not all of his slaves. You know, there were some, obviously, bright young men and women who understood that the institution, that they could do better elsewhere and do better on their own. But he understood that if someone's going to be freed, they ought to be skilled in some task where they can make a living, and would be darn helpful if they were light-skinned, so they would be accepted, perhaps, as a white person, and not have to face the sort of prejudices that a black person might face in any other state, northern states included. So that's an important thing, John.
Yeah.
Where are you going to go? Remember when Sally Hemings' brother James bought his own freedom from Jefferson some years later? He had probably an ebriaction from alcohol. He committed suicide, and that certainly stung Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, so but the basic premise is this idea that he didn't do enough is really laughable when you put it in the context of the time. Okay, but again, it's the paucity of knowledge on the left that they don't take the time to actually do the research. They'll pull a couple snippets out of Wikipedia, and I've watched some of these black leaders on TV talking about some of this stuff. They don't know what the hell they're talking about because they haven't read anything. And I'm here today on the eve of the 4th, and maybe DJT is speaking right now in front of the great monument of Jefferson. And I'm here speaking for those 10,000 free black patriots who fought during the revolution on our side. It wasn't 1619. It wasn't Juneteenth of 1865. These men were out fighting and trying to secure liberty for themselves and their fellow Americans. But we have to discount these men. They don't exist. We got to skip around in history to the Marxist version that best supports their devilish causes. But people like James Armistead Lafayette would be thrown into the dustbin of history, the famous spy who helped George Washington defeat Lord Cornwallis. Wallace. Let's just dump him overboard. How about Peter Salem, who fought at Bunker Hill, or Prince Estabrook, who fought at Lexington, or Crispus Attucks, who was killed at the Boston Massacre, fighting for independence next to white people? So again, this idea that everybody in 1776, every black was a slave, is ridiculous, and it does not hold water. And it just throws away the accomplishments of all these great free black patriots who fought. It's disgraceful, well, Doctor, that we can't let this happen.
Well, let me just
jump. There are a lot of what I call inconvenient truths that relate to the institution of slavery, and it's just not a white-on-black matter, right?
Right.
A lot of that. There were kings, prominent kings, West African kings, who captured through war parties blacks of other tribes and sold them, right, to British investors and so forth, or Americans, to make money, to get other goods. And they rose to great prominence. And one of King Tobegu actually said something when they were trying to eradicate the slave trade in the early 1800s, that, no, this is wrong. We need to keep it open. He gained great celebrity. These kings gained great celebrity. Second, there were white slaves, right? Yep. It's not an oxymoron. I was shown their records during the War of 1812 when they had to have a luxury tax. They have on record two white young men, right? They could have been indentured servants. They could have been slaves, but they were in the capacity of servants, right? Given a luxury tax, they had to be indentured servants or slaves. There were white slaves at the time.
Right.
Thirdly,
right.
Black people owned slaves.
Right.
I have Madam Langley, who ran a whorehouse in Lynchburg. She was a freed black woman who made a heck of a lot of money. I have a picture of her grave in the Old City Cemetery. And she made a heck of a lot of money, could bury herself, have herself buried beautifully, right? And she owned slaves, too. Having and owning slaves was a way of rising in prominence. And, in fact, in the Old South, you know, it was a proud thing to own slaves, and a black person could rise socially by owning slaves.
William Ellison, Doctor, in the book Black Masters, great book, explains that he was one of the biggest owners of slaves, he himself a black man. So this idea that it was a completely racial component of whites oppressing blacks, it was not. It was that economic system at the time that they grew up in that was foisted on them by Great Britain. So just another myth. But another myth is that, well, I mentioned those people who fought for the revolution, but what about those who couldn't vote and they didn't get it until 1870 and when the 15th Amendment was ratified? But actually, free blacks voted from 1776, 1783 in the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, North Carolina. They can vote as equally as a white man. They could be electors. They were on equal terms with anybody else in these states as free men. So again, there's a big myth with this. And a lot of the hatred and a lot of the negativity towards blacks were not like the Django Unchained crap movie that Quentin Tarantino made, that disgraceful depiction of the South. It was actually the North, and I have a heroine from Connecticut called Prudence Crandall in 1832 who tried to educate young free blacks. And the whites in Connecticut burned down her school, you know, and forced her out of the state. And a lot of the racial bigotry was up North. And it's just disgraceful, again, this depiction of slavery in the world. Do you know only about 4% of the slaves that came from Africa came to the southern United States? Most went to Brazil, South America. It's another myth that somehow that, you know, like Cain, that politician who ran with Hillary Clinton, trying to say that it all started in the South and all this. No. There was only about 4 or 5% of the slaves that came over across the Middle Passage were in the United States. So it's just a disgraceful lie that they're perpetrating, as the neo-Bolsheviks do, picking and choosing the bits of history to push their Marxist worldview.
Well, Jefferson saw the hypocrisy of the Northern hypocrisy concerning the issue of slavery, right, when he was confronted late in life with the Missouri problem. And Jefferson says that they're making it a moral issue and he says for political purposes. Why is that? So Jefferson was pro-slavery for Missouri, but it wasn't because he was pro-slavery in his life. He was pro-states' rights, and he was also worried about the increasing political impotency of the South. Now, for example, right, when Abraham Lincoln was elected in 1860, he did not carry a single Southern state.
Nor did he get one Southern vote. Not one Southern vote either.
He won handily the presidential election. The House of Representatives was overwhelmingly comprised Northerners. So the South, it was becoming increasingly clear, in spite of the fact that Jefferson and Madison and Monroe were so popular, and Jeffersonian politics was popular for, you know, over two decades, the South was becoming increasingly politically weak. And that became apparent, as we
exactly
saw. And Jefferson saw that as well, and he knew that the Missouri question was more, the issue of slavery was more a political expedient for the Northerners. He commonly said they can bitch about us using the slaves, but they have no problem shipping them to us, do they? The Northern
right
states. Political thing. And
right,
I tend to think this whole notion that I get nauseous when I hear that the Civil War was a war about slavery. It was, in my estimation, much, much more nuanced and complex. At least the argument was slavery was a part of it, but slavery, it seems to me, there were economic issues that were pushed, and the South was being squeezed economically.
Definitely.
by Northern laws, by federal laws, that was making it increasingly difficult for Southerners on their plantations to survive. Sooner or later, to eradicate the political equalities between the Southern and the Northern ways of life. We had two different ways of thinking about surviving and making it.
Right.
You know, to say that the Civil War was a war fought for slavery is such a, it's trite, it's too commonly iterated, and it, to me, it's ridiculous.
There are two things there. There's two factions going on here. You got two forces. You got the revolutionary America-hating whites out there who want to destroy Western society. So they're using the black problem to help them along with that. And then you got the black radicals who are using the whites to help them because they
right
hate America. And so they're, both sides are using each other. And you've got slavery is the main thing that's always brought up with everything because that's the worst thing that's ever happened, you know, and that's just a and if you go against that or you have any other different opinion other than the one they want, you're for slavery, you know, you're a bigot, you're
right
a hater. So that's why they always associate everything these days with slavery. On the part of the blacks, the reason they want to wipe out the history before the Civil War is because they don't want to be thankful to any white people. They want to wipe out our history because they don't want to be thankful to any white people for actually being the ones who started the process to get rid of slavery that's been around since the Neanderthal man learned how to light a fire. And it's white people, mainly Great Britain and the United States, that started to end the practice and bring it to the fore that it was an evil thing and started to do something about it. They
did it without war, John.
Yeah, and
they chased to war to do it.
They chased down the slave ships. They arrested the captains of those slave ships and put them in prison. These blacks want to reap the benefits of the great country that mainly white people built, but they don't want to have to be thankful to them for that. They want to wipe that part out of it.
Right.
And you want to
doesn't happen overnight, John. You're right.
And if you want to talk about slavery, you got to go back a lot further than 1619. Talk to the Egyptians and the Romans.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how. That's why that jerk Cain, you know, Hillary's running mate, was so stupid when he made that statement. We started slavery. That alone, he should have been forced out of office just for making that statement, because everybody should have said, we've got this stupid person like this in office. What the hell is he doing
yep
there? So that's
John,
what's really going on.
200 years before American independence, over a million whites were enslaved by Arab merchants. So where is the statues being toppled of them? I have a bone to pick with all those people. But one important point that needs to be made, again, when you're talking about the slavery issue in the Civil War, Doctor, yeah, the top 5%, the slaveholding plantation owners, just like the top 1% and 5%, they have their corporate motivations, as Frank was talking about earlier, and they have their big moneyed interests, a lot of money. Over $3 billion was in slave property. That was more than the entire railroad industry on the eve of the Civil War. So all that money was in there, but it was mainly owned by the top 1% to 5%. The average guy like me and Frank and John of Staten Island and you, Professor, who were fighting, as James M. McPherson said in his great book, What They Fought For, where he went in and examined the diaries of the soldiers, he really showed that we were fighting for our country and for our way of life. We weren't fighting for slavery. 95% of the Southern Confederacy soldiers did not own slaves. They were not fighting for the institution of slavery. They were fighting for the Jeffersonian version of the Constitution, which was being trampled on. They entered this society freely, and they expected to be able to get a divorce when they felt the compact was not justly adjudicating their ends. And that was their right to do it. You're not in this thing like for the mafia. You're in it for life. No. So they should have been allowed to leave peacefully. And again, this making a hero out of Lincoln because of it. Again, we know the Emancipation Proclamation didn't free anybody. It was just an attempt at slave revolts beyond enemy lines. He didn't even free the slaves in the territories. So it was a political statement to try and justify all the dead Americans.
I know the Civil War, you know, slavery was not the main thing with the Civil War. It was mainly about the states' rights and everything. We understand that.
Don't fall for the argument.
No, but I don't think it had nothing to do with slavery, because it's not just an accident that after the Civil War, the slaves were freed.
Yeah, well, was it an accident that every other country in the Western Hemisphere ended slavery peacefully and didn't have to go to war? So that's just blood on his hands and a usurper of the Constitution.
Everybody knew, even by the time of the Declaration of Independence, that the writing was on the wall that slavery would be eradicated at some point in time.
Exactly.
All people knew that. At least the more enlightened people recognized that there's something egregiously wrong with it. Now, when you're immersed in something like a slave-owning state, when you live there, there was an interesting example I put in my book, Lynchburg, of a man who moved from Connecticut to Virginia, and he writes immediately a letter to his father about just how vile Virginia is, how backward they own slaves, these people are wicked people. 2 years later, he writes another letter to his father, and he says, you know, slavery, there's nothing wrong with slavery. The only thing wrong with it is when you treat your slaves poorly, right? So the point is that when you're immersed in something, when you're living in a culture where there is a practice, you don't see it. So to one question is, why were people somewhat reluctant in the South to not free their slaves? There are economic reasons, clearly. But you're living in a time where we're participating in something that we know today is wrong, and they probably did, but they didn't think about it a lot. When I lived in Colorado the first time and I saw the beautiful Rocky Mountains, I was just awed by them. After a year living there, I didn't look at them very much. I didn't think too much about their beauty. They just were there. There are so many things that we do today. The practice of war, many would argue, myself included, is a wicked institution and ought to be eradicated. Yet we participate freely in war when circumstances come up.
Same thing with the supposed Civil War, right? It shouldn't have happened the way it did, but...
Well, first of all, what's never mentioned, is that the South told Great Britain, if you recognize our Confederacy, we'll free all our slaves. So how could the war have been for slavery if the South was ready to free them in return for Great Britain recognizing them, which would have given them military and material aid? So that's a fact that's never heard of. And since the and you could, I draw this historic analogy. since there was a minority of a minority that was slave owners, and the Confederate soldiers were not fighting to preserve slavery, we could look then at Bolshevik Russia during World War II. You only had 2 or 3% of the population were members of the Bolshevik Party, but the Russian people weren't fighting to preserve Bolshevism. That's why Stalin called it the Great War for the Fatherland. They were fighting for Mother Russia. So I see the same analogy. And yet that analogy and that fact that they wanted recognition from Britain and they would have freed the slaves is never, ever mentioned. That's why I don't get my history from the pseudo-mythology channel, the so-called history channel, or from any movies, because it's all stacked against the facts.
Exactly.
Well, there's another issue, too, apropos of race, is that Jefferson followed the leading scientists of his day. And with Enlightenment thinking, the notions of liberty and equality being posited, the study of race was for the first time undertaken. This had never been done before. We had people like Linnaeus categorizing living things. We had scientists like Comte de Buffon, Oliver Goldsmith, George Cuvier, some of the leading naturalists in the world, looking at human skulls, looking at the physical, obvious physical differences between blacks and Europeans and Asians and Native Americans, and they were trying to come up with explanations for why there were such physical differences. And more than that, they believed that there were not just physical differences, but differences in, if you want to call it, cultural or moral maturation. And John, you mentioned the uncivilized blacks from Africa being brought here. You know, you can't say that these days. Every culture is the same. We can't make evaluative claims in terms of one culture being more civilized or less civilized. That's not done today. And yet, you know, when you're sick, do you go to your local witch doctor? Or to ask for a consensus of your friends about what you do? No, you go to your doctor, your local MD, because they have made the study of medicine a practice. There are cultures that are more advanced than others. I'm not saying that makes that culture morally better culture, because with such advances, we also develop technologies to eradicate ourselves, like bombs and nuclear weapons. But the point is that we do make scientific advances. We do make mathematical advances, and there are advances in astronomy, biotechnology. And, you know, the leftist relativists want to deny that any of these things are actually happening. There's no evaluative claims we want to make other than the fact that if you owned slaves, you were bad. That's
The human being himself is just a virus that's taking over this earth and polluting the earth and destroying it. They really just don't even have a love of humanity in them. And they don't understand when you're extending life expectancies, when you're helping the human condition and, you know, doing all the great things that sprouted from these great free enterprise ideas of the founding fathers. I mean, how that can't be appreciated when, again, you can see what's going on in South Africa right now, that, you know, sometimes when you have local warlords take over like they did in the CHOP occupied zone, sometimes it doesn't end up as peaceful as they claim in their Marxist worldview it somehow will magically become. But yet more people, as Frank have said, have died because of class hatred in the Marxist class struggle than have ever died from racism or anything like that. But like you were saying, Jefferson was very close to understanding some of this evolutionary stuff. Now, Darwin hadn't even come around yet, but he was still very close as he was figuring out the seashells on the top of the mountain, and he knew something wasn't quite right with it. He almost figured that out. I mean, really, he was maybe a decade away from figuring that out, Doctor. But yet you have the Nazis and the communists, you know, following the Herbert Spencer doctrines in the early, you know, 1900s. I mean, he almost figured it out in his day, but yet they were still using the phrenologies heading into World War II. You know, but somehow we got to condemn Jefferson because he couldn't quite pick it up fast enough and be able to analyze this. But he spoke about human equality, and he understood generally that all men are created equal.
Yeah, so let's get the record straight, too. He, in his query 14 of his notes on Virginia, he, throughout the notes on Virginia, I have a book I just finished, which is a commentary. I call it a prolegomena to Thomas Jefferson's notes. By prolegomen, I mean things you need to know before even picking up the book, because presentism in evaluations of the book is just so common that we fail to understand what Jefferson's trying to do. You have to understand there was no evolutionary biology at the time.
Right.
For example, Jefferson, early on in the notes, thought that, you know, when he's talking about the bones of the mammoth, he thought that the mammoth still existed because we're dealing with the scala naturae, the scale of nature, that God was perfect. And when God created, God was not wasteful. So there was a scale from the lowest infusorians all the way up to human beings, and there was no break in the chain. The lowest organisms trying to raise themselves above to be the highest organisms, and that's the way God directed it. And towards the end of his life, Jefferson came to disavow that view. He believed that extinction was real, that
exactly.
The fossils that he was looking at, the fossils were not sort of an intermediary thing between biotic things and inorganic things. He came to realize that fossils were just instances of organisms that once existed that no longer exist. So the science was massively underdeveloped, but it was growing at a fast pace. Now, I want to read a quote that shows that we talk about Jefferson's prejudicial views of blacks. Now, I want to say one thing first. We want to talk about his racism. We need to define a race, and we need to define prejudice, racism. Jefferson did not prejudge. The views he articulated in Notes on Virginia that blacks were of lesser intelligence, of less physical beauty, of less imagination, he articulated as probability claims, right? And he goes on to say, we don't know for sure, but in all probability, these are true. But he also makes the concession that black people are just as moral as all people. And as I said before, morality was very important. But let's read this interesting claim, and as it relates to us today. Here's my point, is with the 1619 Project, the New York Times magazine people probably thinking they do a lot of good. Are we doing good? Are we creating more tension between the races by crap like that? That's my view. Listen to what Jefferson writes here. He says, deep-rooted prejudices entertained by the whites. 10,000 recollections by the blacks of the injuries they have sustained, new provocations, the real distinctions which nature has made in many other circumstances will divide us into parties and produce convulsions which will probably never end but in the extermination of one or the other race. Jefferson is blaming white people for the prejudices in this. Number one. Number two, he's noting that the sufferings of the black slaves are such that they're not going to forget for a long time. Now, how long ago was that written? Published in 1787,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we're still feeling it.
What is it, 250 years later plus?
Right.
How much have things improved?
Right. That's why if slavery had ended peacefully instead of by war and all the whites being disenfranchised after the War of Northern Aggression, we would have achieved more racial equality much quicker, probably by the turn of the century there. We really would have, but instead we got set back through the racial division, and thus came the rise of the Klan and trying to fight for white rights again against disenfranchisement. I mean, it's just awful when you think about it, but those words were very prophetic.
Politically correct left is doing here, and this is where you guys are right on the money. They're advocating that white self-flagellation. Let's just beat ourselves senseless. Let's just wallow in our guilt. Is this doing anything? Is this setting things back to a state where we're going to create even greater tensions? Are they solving the problem? I don't think they are. I think they're creating a greater problem than there needs to be. We need to move forward on these issues. Let's have a plan to settle racial tensions and not just sit there and blame, and wallow in guilt. I am not going to be ashamed for being a white person, and if I were black, I would not be ashamed for being a black person.
E pluribus unum, doctor. We're supposed to...
That's right. We're all one. Let's work together to affect some of the problems here. Let's not sit there and play the blame game. It's not taking us anywhere, and it's creating a greater problem. Now, you notice, I don't know if you read that, I think it was Guyana is inviting black people who are dissatisfied with the racial inequalities in our country to go there.
Yeah, that was Lincoln's idea.
Them, the colonization articulated society. Expatriation as well, because he just realized we probably couldn't get along.
Right. Doctor, do you remember the trip famously that James Madison and Jefferson took as they went around through Connecticut and New York and around? I remember a story from that to where they came upon a freehold farmer who was so industrious they were just amazed. And I really think at that point Jefferson was like, wow, it really is true that they can be just as industrious as anybody else if allowed freedom and liberty. So he saw it in his lifetime. And I remember that from his trip when him and Madison were discussing that, you know, so he saw
very
it. He
excellent
understood
point,
it.
John. Let me elaborate on that.
Okay.
When Jefferson said blacks were of limited and not the equal of whites in intelligence and imagination, what did he think they were like? You notice James Hemings, right, the one who committed suicide, became a gourmet chef in France, right? John Hemings was skilled in carpentry, excellent at carpentry. Blacks were doing the same thing that whites were doing. So when he's talking about them not being of the same capacity of whites, he's talking about them not being able to participate fully in the fine arts and in political affairs. They would be comparable to what we call the Quakers today. Right. Is that really backward? In other words, all black people, Jefferson thought, are just like most white people. They can get along, they can do simple math, they can write letters, they can learn skills, they can live just like most white people. What Jefferson was saying, and we know he's wrong today, is that they just wouldn't be able to participate in the fine arts, in the subtleties of politics, and in the higher sciences. You're not going to find a black Isaac Newton. Now, we know that, you know, Jefferson was wrong. And the point is, he would, if he were alive today, recognize that what he said was wrong. That's all.
And,
that's what racism is. Racism is an inability to retract your claim. There's no retractation if you're racist. No matter what evidence someone puts forth, I'm going to say black people are inferior. Jefferson never thought that way. He was a scientist, and if he put forth an hypothesis that was wrong, he was willing, when evidence showed him wrong, to change his view.
Yeah, well,
that's
when,
why you need, doctor, you need a contextualization and a thorough understanding of the work. And Jefferson read 10,000 books.
It's Jefferson read 10,000 books. Racism is bad. Jefferson was bad.
Yeah. Well, where did this nonsense start?
The secular university and any, you know, the day was going to come where blacks could learn, you know, and be educated as anybody else could be educated, and it was coming, and that's the point, is he set the foundations for all this greatness, but this is what the neo-Marxist wants to tear down when they want to rewrite history and don't understand the full view of it. Oil slicks, doc, they're on the top with no depth, right on the top of the water, picking and choosing little snippets off of Wikipedia instead of picking up a damn book and really researching what the hell they're talking about.
I don't ever remember any stories about the pilgrims bringing over slaves. They came over here to escape religious persecution and start, you know, their own freedom as far as religion. Where did this nonsense start that the pilgrims suddenly brought slaves with them? They just made that up. How come no one's corrected that lie? And when did this start all of a sudden? The pilgrims brought slaves with them. No, they didn't. They came over here for, you know, on their own.
Speak out. You're a racist.
Yeah, that's what I said.
That's the attack against you now, huh? Are you suddenly now the king of the racists, doctor?
What is a slave? If we tried to define what slavery is, that's a contentious issue. And Jefferson saw, and I wrote something, that Jefferson believed in degrees of slavery. And that's a strange thing because in his declaration, he doesn't allow for degrees of slavery. It's a categorical assessment. You either have freedom. But in the political sense, he says slavery and freedom are absolutes, and I agree with that politically. But in the all practice of everyday affairs in the world, there are degrees of slavery. Jefferson, in one of his letters, points to the practice of British impressment. Everybody knows what that is. The British, mm-hmm. because they had the world's largest navy, needed yep. sailors for their ships. So they would stop at random other ships, force these sailors to come on board their ships and become British sailors. And Jefferson says that, is that not slavery, and perhaps even worse, because exactly. these men are taken thousands of miles away from their families unwillingly.
Which is one of the reasons for the embargo and how that ended up being a failed policy, but it was an attempt at him to avoid war, to try some of these coercive policies that the Constitution set up to where you're supposed to control commerce, and he was trying to avoid war. So he was literally trying to stop that human slavery where American citizens were being stolen and impressed. I mean, just another thing that, again, where they can twist the history as something bad, as something failed, when really he was, again, ahead of his time there, trying to avoid war, to use coercive economics, as DJT is beating down China using today.
Yeah, and, you know, he's often castigated quite severely for the embargo. And I think there are several reasons why he went in that direction, one of which is that a war with England, we were ill prepared for a war with England, and it would have been a losing war, and Jefferson realized that. But he also realized we had to do something to save face. But he also was committed to nonviolent means of effecting political changes, and he was, you know, he was no Gandhi. He was not categorically committed to nonviolence. No. He believed in violence in extreme cases, but he did believe in pacific measures more than any other political person of his day, perhaps.
To prevent slavery and pro-freedom, sure. And that's why he sent out the Marines for the Barbary Pirates.
Yeah, and that was a maneuver that wasn't very popular at the time. People kept wanting to pay them exorbitant sums when you could just eliminate the problem by war with the Barbary Pirates, which was effectively done, by the way.
Yep. Yeah. Go ahead, Jeff.
No, I was going to say the whole thing, this whole controversy, it's contrived. They have to, if they didn't have something to be mad at the Founding Fathers for, they'd find something else, because their goal is to just bring us down so that they can take control. Here they are talking about enslaving people, dictatorships, and this, but they are the ones who want to become the dictators.
Yeah, right.
I'm not sold on that. I think we're dealing with a body people that are just too damned ignorant to assume control, and they wouldn't know what to do with it. My view is, and I could be wrong, is that they just want to complain. They want to bitch. And in doing so, they gain tremendous notoriety. They get a lot of sympathy, and they gain, as I said, monetarily.
It's easier to bitch than work.
To talk about them immersed in, the thinking, the neo-Marxist thinking, is to do them a little bit too much justice of being thinking individuals. That would require that they do reading and thinking and beyond what they're capable of doing.
I think it's a lot more than complaining, because even now you see them, they want to silence anyone who disagrees with them. They want to control people's movements. They want to dictate what you can say on and off campus. They want to dictate who can be a guest wherever they are. They want to dictate how much money you can make. You name it. These people are just, they're out after, they want to eliminate anything in the Constitution that gives you the right to defend yourself. They'll tell you how to live, and they want to get rid of the First Amendment.
Yep. Hey, hey, ho, ho, Western culture has got to go.
Yeah,
famously said that one.
Jesse Jackson.
Yeah. So it's really just an attack on Western culture, and it's an attack on those values that came to us, starting with the great Cristoforo Colombo that made all this happen, but they want to demonize him and everybody else that followed. Because as Frank says, if you delegitimize the beginning, then everything else that came after is evil, and it's okay to tear it down. It's okay to burn it down. It's okay to destroy the history. And I thought they were such devotees of artwork, but I guess it's only artwork that the neo-Bolsheviks put in a category that they agree with.
Well, yeah, just to apply the term "hey, hey, ho, ho" to something, and that makes their argument a legitimate argument. Everything starts with a slogan with them.
Yeah, well,
and I've read this on the show before, but it's so prescient. From 1984, on page 53, it says that Winston Smith is in the cafeteria having this conversation, and they're talking about the newspeak, and he says to someone, "Don't you see the whole aim of newspeak is to narrow the range of thought? In the end, we shall make thought crime literally impossible because there will be no words in which to express it. Every concept that can ever be needed will be expressed by exactly one word, with its meaning rigidly defined and all its subsidiary meanings rubbed out and forgotten. Already in the 11th edition, we're not far from that point, but the process will still be continuing long after you and I are dead. Every year, and this is the key, and if you think about what's going on, this is the key sentence. Every year, fewer and fewer words, and the range of consciousness will always be a little smaller. Even now, of course, there's no reason or excuse for committing thought crime. It's merely a question of self-discipline, reality control. But in the end, there won't be any need even for that. The revolution will be complete when the language is perfect. Hmm. Has it ever occurred to you, Winston, by the year 2050, hey, we're only 30 years away from what George Orwell prophesied, at the very latest, not a single human being will be alive who could understand such a conversation as we are having now. Now, don't tell me that this isn't what they want. They want to totally change the English language by their getting rid of words, and you see it all the time. There's an article I was going to read when towards the end of the show about now, and it was in the Wall Street Journal. Every week they review different automobiles, and this review by Dan Neal, and he says why it's time for Jeep to rethink problematic monikers. And all these different names that cars have are offensive. And he goes down the list. So don't use those anymore. Look at when they advertise a house or an apartment to rent or lease or buy. We shouldn't use the word master bedroom because it has the connotations from slavery. So they want to literally do what George Orwell wrote in 1984. You keep on narrowing down the language. And that's yep. what the neo-Bolshevik left in this country is doing. Just keep on eliminating words. Ooh, I use that. Oh, my God. That's a thought crime. I shouldn't say that.
Yep.
That's the danger
of the
left.
And this is why they won't let
understand.
Dr. Holochak's books go to Monticello or Poplar Forest, right, Doc? They won't let out the argument.
No,
they won't let a reasoned discussion happen.
I'm convinced in time that, you know, it's cleaning out the Augean stables. This crap will pass. And, you know, the sort of garbage that is seen to pass as ship today will be looked on in history years from now as a sort of dark age, right? What bothers me in all of this quote-unquote discussion from the radical left here, this political correctness, there's no appeal to reason. They are not using any sort of rational line of argumentation. It's all done by appealing to emotion. As Frank, I think you were just saying, you know, in reducing the vocabulary, it's an appeal to emotion. What bothers me, what scares the holy hell out of me, is that it's been so successful in the hearts of the American public. Why are we so swayed by this? Why need I feel guilty about being a white person? Or if I am a black person, why should I feel guilty? You know, why should any of this have such be so persuasive to the common people? And yet
because
it is.
They're uneducated.
Right? Well, you know, and that's because we live in a time, you know, unlike Jefferson's time, where reason is just not prized. In the academics, I taught philosophy for 33 years, for you know, for goodness sake. And, you know, reason is just not that important. In one of my classes, I was taught at one institution, a very, very prominent institution in the West, I won't mention it, that no matter what a student says, say, good question. I can't do that. Some questions are insipid. I'm not going to tell a student that a question is stupid, but I'm not going to say, really good question, something that is just thrown out there to show that you're interested in the class even though you haven't done the readings.
Yeah, you better not use a red magic marker, Doc. Did they tell you not to use a red magic marker?
Yeah, but in education, and I've seen that in the last 10 years, 15 years of teaching, students do not buy books anymore. There's this sense of entitlement. And this fits right in with the radical left movement, is that, okay, everything's just, leave everything fine, and the students are great, and everything's going to be fine. Let's just tolerate everything, right, except, you know, things, that racial inequality and stuff like that. The point is that we're living, this is a really dangerous period in which we're going through right now. And I don't know what's going to happen, but I think that these issues, 1619 Project, and, you know, the issue of race at Monticello, I think we're creating a greater and greater gap. This is going to lead to white animosity. It's not going to lead to, and I don't want to see that. I want to see people working together, you know, for the greater good of the country.
Hopefully it leads to what Frank predicted, and that we'll have another silent majority where the great white unspoken majority steps up and speaks and says, enough of this. You can only degrade me so much. So on November 3rd, if we lose this one, we're in big trouble. And so it'll completely unreasonable masses you talked about will be in full control. The radical leftist anarchists will be in full control. We need to beat that back, and we need to start now.
And there is no working things out with the left.
No,
we have nothing.
Separation may be the only way, John. We have to remove ourselves from them, because the only thing they produce, as Frank says, is slogans, parades, and propaganda.
Yeah, there's
nothing of any substance, and we want nothing from them, but they want everything from us.
Right,
everything.
Right, and there's no compromise. We have
no coexistence, no cooperation.
No, we have nothing in common with them. And they're not interested in compromise. They're interested in one thing: total power and control and total victory. To them, when you compromise with them, you lose.
And if they came, John, before the four of us and tried to spout their nonsense, do you understand how easily we would crumble it and make them look like fools? Do you understand they can't throw arcane points at
right.
any one of the four of us and throw us off their game as they try to, you know, knock these people down? Not going to knock us down, okay? We're fully versed. We understand the doctrine. We understand when you support freedom and liberty, what it leads to. When you support class, Marxist aggression, the mass murder that leads to. We know these things, so
I would love
for anybody to step up. But that's why they shout you down at the Monticello.
Right.
They'll shout down anybody on a university who speaks the way we do, because they don't want an open discussion anymore.
No, because
they can't.
We need to fight
for our country and bring that back.
They can't win it. That's why.
Well, why do you think I've never been invited? In fact, when I've asked for debates on the issue of Jefferson's paternity, I don't even get an email back. But let me make a distinction that the great Hugh Blair made, the book to which I referred. He talked about oratory, or fine writing that is aimed at conviction, and oratory, or fine writing that is aimed at persuasion. Oratory aimed at conviction is just a matter of convincing somebody. And that's what's going on in this segment, this talk show, right? Conviction. But conviction is not enough. Right, for what we're going through right now. We are going to the politically correct police. We need action. We need persuasion. We need to discuss things in such a manner so that the people that are listening and agree that we need reasoned discussion. So we need to force the issue. So here there's an invitation as we're getting towards the end. I have an invitation for your listeners to go out and act. To not sit around and just take the garbage that's been thrown out, that you know, all the stuff that's going on by the politically correct left, and let's demand Do it at the polls, but do it too, en masse. Let's demand to be heard, to have a voice, and let's demand to bring open, free, rational, underscore the rational discussion into try to settling these problems.
And I'm going to put, Doctor, on the website some of the contact information of people who we do need to contact and fight against. But I said a couple weeks ago on the show, I think I've figured out what my destiny is, and maybe you'll join me in this, Doctor, is that I picture myself as being a Monticello martyr. I'm ready to stand at the bottom of that mountain with my shotgun and my rifle, well-armed, just like a Minuteman militia, and prevent those devilish left-wing Democrat hordes from attacking our great shrine up there on the hill. Will you join me and become a Monticello martyr? Maybe that's where we can make our stand.
I often thought that it wouldn't be a bad thing to go there and loudly protest to such that one got arrested and really get some voice and some visibility that way.
Doc, but if the left-wing mobs go to Monticello, they're going to burn it down, but they're going to burn down the Sally Hemings exhibit that all these liberal Annette Gordon Reed, the high priestess of the Hemings cult, put up there. So can you imagine when they try to destroy Jefferson's house? They're going to actually destroy all the stupid stuff that that cult is pushing.
Well, the shock is that he never had an affair with Sally Hemings. He was not interested in a child, however beautiful she was. Jefferson's interest in women were women who were highly sophisticated, usually in the fine arts. His wife was a gifted pianist and could sing beautifully. Maria Cosway, the woman with whom he fell in love while in France, was an artist, a composer, and gifted at several instruments. Sally Hemings never could have or would have interested him in the least. And it's sort of a shame what they're doing to his legacy. And that bespeaks another point. If we have, and it's a point I made on before, if we have no respect for the men and women who made the ultimate sacrifices for this country, there's no hope for a future. We can't have a future without a significant past. And this country, if any country, really has a remarkable past. And then we have the 4th of July tomorrow. Let's keep in our hearts and minds, and let's talk about Thomas and John Adams and all the people, George Washington. Let's talk, keep these people in our minds and our hearts. And again, let's act. Let's just not talk. It's a talk show. But right, we're talking here not just to persuade, to convince you that what we're saying is true. We're talking to convince you to act, to liberate our country. We need to take our country back again. We lost it. We're losing it.
I think it starts on November 3rd, and we have a man of action in the White House who mainly supports what we're talking about. And that's where we have to start and then continue to battle. But if they take over in November, you'll be silenced almost immediately and probably run out of Virginia. But, Doctor, we do want to thank you for coming on and giving us all this extra time tonight. This was a great, great discussion, and hopefully people learned a lot, which is why we have you on to educate us on these things, because you've put in the work. You've done your time. The hundreds and hundreds of books you've read, it's very impressive, and you are an inspiration to me as well, Doctor.
Thousands. And let's say at the outset, none of what we're espousing here is hatred, is racism. As much as anybody, are champion, you know, racial equality, and we have concern that we have the sort of society that embraces racial equality and welcomes Black Americans, Native Americans, and all sorts of peoples from all persuasions in this country. It's a melting pot.
Yeah, on my personal Mount Rushmore is the great Clarence Thomas. He is a personal hero to everybody on this show and in this audience. It has nothing to do with race. It does have to do with the content of character. And boy, the persecution he went through and how he stood up to the Marxist, neo-Bolshevik left, he is a hero. If you go back and look at those trials that he went to, those show trials where Biden was a part of it, he stood his ground on principle and said, I'm going to be an individual who's going to stand for what I believe in. And you know what he believes in? A strict Jeffersonian construction of the Constitution. He is a Jeffersonian hero. Hail Clarence Thomas, and thank you again for coming on tonight, Dr. Holacek.
Thank you for having me. As always, I enjoyed myself. And one thing I'll say when I come on the show, I was interviewed really briefly on Wednesday by a local radio talk show, and the conversation was so unstructured and went off in so many different directions. It was a disaster. When the person emailed me, said it was an excellent interview, I said, no, it wasn't. And I wasn't really putting blame, but, you know, there has to be structure to a conversation. And you guys always have an environment where there is structure, there is a telos, an end to which we're arguing for. And so I want to congratulate you for having a show that has structured critical assessment going on, right? I was asked questions that had nothing to do with Thomas Jefferson. As a Jefferson scholar, you'd think me'd bring me up to talk about Jefferson, but, you know, anyways, but you
yep,
very much for
having
me.
You've joined the cavalcade, Doctor, of TRP intellectuals. Congratulations.
Yes, please come back.
Thank you very much.
He will.
Good night.
All right. Good night, gentlemen. Great
stuff. Have a great night,
tonight.
Guys. Bye.
All right.
All right. He's good.
Yeah, he's so is John.
Yeah, he's never at a loss for words.
Yeah,
that's for sure.